You are listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 14th of June 2022 on Monocle 24.
Why the world can't or won't maintain a united front against Russia? Is it finally all over for the Iran nuclear deal? And Monocle makes its annual choice of the world's most livable city. Put the champagne on ice, Wagga Wagga. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Baria Alamuddin and Somnath Battabile will discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll have a report on the flight of growing numbers of Russians to Latin America. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I'm joined today by Baria Alamuddin, international journalist and broadcaster, and by Somnath Battabile, lecturer in media and development and international journalism at SOAS. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi.
Baria, we were just talking about this outside, and we will mention it now because it's sort of going to come up. You have just been travelling in the Gulf-ish.
Yes, I have. I went to Bahrain, and I really like to go there. I have many friends, and although the weather was really hot, but I like that city. It's not fake, as opposed to many new cities in the Gulf that have these very, very high skyscrapers and sort of lost their identity. In Bahrain, there is a lot of history, and Bahrain is not a very rich country like other Gulf states, like Qatar, for example, or Dubai, or so that the people are authentically nice and kind, and I like that about them.
Somnath, you have not, we established, been anywhere that recently, however.
No, the liberal university has been keeping me tied up. Students as consumers demanding more and more.
I like liberal, by the way.
We will start today's show proper with Russia, which does remain notably undissuaded from continuing its rampage in Ukraine. The city of Severodonetsk, which was 4 months ago home to 100,000 people, is now completely cut off. Every bridge connecting it to the rest of Ukraine now destroyed. As President Vladimir Putin of Russia has doubtless calculated, the longer he can sustain the fight and the better he can consolidate Russian gains, the better his chances that the world's resolve will fracture and falter. Baria, first of all, are we already seeing indications that this is already starting to happen?
Well, I pray not, and I hope not. I do not like very much what Macron is doing in France, and still importing gas from Russia, and importing even more gas than that. And also, you know, when people preempt peace talks and say, you know, Ukraine should give more territory, etc. Already Russia controls a lot of the territory of Ukraine. And exactly what are you trying to say? Are you trying to encourage other countries and other dictators in the world to actually go and wage war and occupy other people's land? This is not a European quality, I would hope, especially Western European quality. And this is, you know, these countries are bastions of democracy. It's like today in the UK, I'm ashamed even to say I'm British, with all these migrants being loaded on planes, on a plane to go to Rwanda. I mean, Rwanda? Are you kidding me? It's not a bastion of human rights.
It is far from that.
Yeah. So yes, I going back to Ukraine, I'm worried about that. I hope not, because I think the Europeans will live to regret that. Russia and under the patronage of Putin and the leadership of Putin is not a country that should be encouraged. It's a country that should be restrained, that should be watched, and that should be stopped.
Well, Somnath, this is increasingly the schism that appears to be developing, the one that Baria delineates there, which is between those countries, which is broadly at the moment the United States and the United Kingdom, saying Russia needs to lose this and Ukraine needs to win. And ideally, Russia needs to be returned not merely to its February 24th jumping off point, but actually chased out of Ukraine entire, versus what we are starting to hear from the likes of France and Germany, that maybe we do need to try and and find a negotiated way out of this. Macron, as you were alluding to there, Barrier, suggesting that the West does not want to humiliate Putin. That's a division that Putin can usefully exploit, though, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, and I completely agree with Barrier. We must remember what happened, when we started appeasing Hitler. You know, and I don't want to draw very easy comparisons across time, but Western leaders know this. But I want to talk about, you were talking about the fractures which are developing in the coalition. I want to come to this in a slightly different angle. Late 1950s, early 60s, there was a book which came out called The Structures of Foreign News by Galtung and Rouge. And there were several factors they listed why something becomes front page in a different country. Ukraine hits many of those fronts. Proximity, casualty, immediacy. But slowly as we see, as time passes, those factors drop and others come. High inflation, some idiotic stuff the UK government constantly keeps on doing, Rwanda and flights. Today the UN food program has cut aid from very, very vulnerable Sudanese victims of hunger just because of Ukraine crisis, because it has to divert funds. So other things take over. So the coalition will fracture. It's very difficult to keep it together. I know the Western countries have this outrage over why India is not doing it, why other countries are not joining in, why China. It forgets that the Western coalition doesn't look after universal interests. You know, there are other interests also. And I'm not saying that India or China is doing the right thing here at all, morally, no. But they're competing global interests, and we are playing in this. And Putin, very, very diplomatically, knows that this is a long-term war of attrition, and perhaps is slowly having an upper hand. Look at the oil imports. The reserves are going up.
Because he put down his prices,
absolutely,
didn't he?
And
yeah, but I think also the brutality and the savageness is also making the news stay with us. I know, for example, that CNN has spent a whole year's budget on 3 months of war in Ukraine, and now they're slashing out.
Absolutely.
But you have to do that. I'm sure the BBC is probably doing the same thing. But I pray that the media will keep this item on the front pages and on the headlines, because we cannot let this go. This has huge implications, not only on human rights and the future of Europe and the new nuclear war, but also on the whole world structure and geography, and what do we allow and not what we allow. I'm sure China is watching very, very closely.
Oh, indeed so. But is the problem here, Somnath, perhaps that we don't yet really grasp what the Western world, if we can think of it as one entity, thinks is actually the desirable outcome here? Because there is that fracture that Barry was discussing earlier between those who think Russia just must be beaten and seen to be beaten, or those who think, for various reasons, that maybe we should try and call it a draw.
I can see both points. One, that you do not want to appease a person who has really, really outraged all human concerns. The other is, how long can this go on? How many more bodies how many more people have to die? How many
well,
more?
There community? Are any number of Bosnians who could give you a bleak answer to that question.
Oh, God. I know.
Yeah.
And this has to happen. There will be a fracture there cannot be a unanimous world reaction to this, simply because there's so many competing priorities at the same time. And nations have different priorities. So I don't know the correct answer. I don't know. I agree with Barry that this cannot be allowed to happen. And the Western world, from the start, the unity that was there should remain. But I can see why Germany and France seem to say, can we find a way out of this? Because this has gone on for very long. And it plays into Putin's hand. I know this too, as I'm saying this.
But you don't have to go. Diplomacy has a chance, definitely, and it should be diplomatic. But you don't appease him. You don't tell him you can take more territory. You, quite the contrary.
Henry Kissinger's statement was completely out of line.
No. But he explained it. There was an interview on the Sunday Times where he said, "This is not what I said. I didn't really say that. It was taken out of context." And I believe Kissinger. Kissinger is not a coward. He doesn't have to take anything back. I admire him in certain things. Don't admire him in others. But we live at this moment in such a dangerous world that we really have to stop and think. And I think what we are talking about next is a point to be taken as well.
Well, indeed. And given that you have queued the next item up nicely for us there, even as a large amount of the democratic world has been arraying itself in opposition to Russia, there has been at least one diplomatic process ongoing in which the democratic world and Russia are broadly on the same side. This is the languishing effort to resurrect the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, better known as the Iran nuclear deal. This is the agreement concluded in 2015 to restrict Iranian nuclear activity, rent asunder in 2018 when then US President Donald Trump flounced out of it. Current reports suggest that talks are at best becalmed, at worst altogether stalled. But Baria, first of all, seeing as how you helped introduce the item, it's hard to know quite what the signals are, because Iran has said that an agreement is within reach. That's what they've said. But when you look at what they've done, which is switched off a lot of the surveillance cameras in their facilities, which signal is serious there? Because it's often the case towards the end of any negotiation that people do try and up the stakes a bit. So is Iran showboating here in a bid to try and get a better deal or to force everybody to a deal? Or is this Iran signalling we're not interested?
Oh, they're definitely interested. The problem is you're talking about similar regimes here, and they're best friends, by the way. Iran, the Iranian regime and Putin are amazingly very close friends. And they do a lot of business together. And indeed, a lot of the times,
Russia doesn't want Iran having a bomb, though.
No, they don't. No, they don't. But they. You see, the Russian strategy is a very, very clever one. Putin is a good strategist, in my opinion. I hate to say it, but it's the truth. What Iran is doing is actually really, really lying all the way through. What Iran is doing, Iran is one of the richest countries in the area, and the Iranian heritage is so rich and wonderful. The people of Iran are poor. Mm. People are demonstrating in the streets because they cannot find food, they cannot find medicine, they cannot find... and they tell their people lies after lies after lies. And what they have done is create a militia in Iraq. And I wrote a book called The Militia State about these militias in Iraq. They have a militia in my country, Lebanon, called Hezbollah, that is destroying literally the country. They have the Houthis. And they would like to control, the Gulf. And they want to control Mecca, for example. Can you believe it? They have bombarded Abu Dhabi, sent missiles to on the oil. This is a recipe for real serious economic disaster. Why? Because the world economy depends on the oil for the time being, and the oil reserves are in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Abu Dhabi, Qatar, and all that. And fancy a war there. I mean, it will be really destructive, not in a much bigger way than the war with Ukraine is. And people don't know and don't visualize and don't understand. I constantly write about the subject because we are appeasing. The Americans appeased Iran. And this 2015, actually, that Obama did was a disaster because he did not include all the other malicious things that Iran was doing. You can't have militias in other countries. You can't send missiles to the people in Gaza. And every time the Hamas sends missiles into Israel, they practically destroy Gaza. So this is a very serious thing to do. And I agree with you. I think that the agreement is in real jeopardy. And also, the Americans have to take this much more seriously, and they have to have a plan, goddammit. They don't have one. Neither the Europeans.
The weird thing, or one of the weird things about this, Somnath, always strikes me, is that Iran keeps behaving like it is negotiating from a position of strength, but it's actually not, is it? I mean, its economy is a wreck. It is widely disliked, I think it's fair to say, the regime, that is. It doesn't actually have any real allies. It has a few clients and a couple of friends of convenience. So what's your analysis as to from where Iran finds the nerve to try and dictate terms on this?
It's amazing, isn't it? It's very close to, as we find out, to having a nuclear bomb, right?
Well, so some analysts believe, yes. Right? And some, in fact, believe that Iran may already be weapons capable if they wish to be.
So how can we say that they're not negotiating from a position of strength? They either have it or they're almost going to have it, and then they're negotiating from that position. It's a position of immense strength, I think. They are holding all the cards and then now playing America.
I don't think they hold all the cards.
And this is where this is where I was going to defer to you. You know much more about this, Barry, than I do.
It's really myself. And don't forget the Israeli position here, because Israel now is threatening, and every single day almost now, we have the Israelis inside Iran, inside Tehran, killing these scientists.
We have seen two more died this weekend in somewhat dubious-looking circumstances.
Young, brilliant scientists killed in their position of work. And also last week and the last 2 weeks, there have been generals killed in front of their homes inside the capital of Tehran. So when they talk about this very strong Iran army and you know, RCG, etc., this is all bluffing and it's a lie.
So you feel that the
they're not strong.
No. What I'm trying to ask is that are they close to a nuclear bomb?
Oh, definitely.
Or do you feel,
this is not a feeling. This is information.
But this is the
IAEA.
This is what leads me to the question that I always end up asking about the Iran nuclear deal, which is that isn't this all kind of nonsense anyway? Because everybody involved in this knows, whether they want to admit it out loud or not, that the guarantor of last resort here, that Iran will never have a nuclear weapon, is in fact Israel, which will do whatever it thinks it needs to do to stop Iran from having one. You know, and Israel has considerable form for this, as you know, having bombed one reactor in Iraq and another one in Syria. They'll do it again in Iran if they think there's not an option.
And don't forget, this is going to create a race, because if you see the Gulf countries, if a country like Saudi Arabia, so rich, so powerful, thinks that Iran has a nuclear weapon, who's going to stop them from having one? So we will have many countries having one, not only Israel. It's enough that we have Israel. What we should have is no nuclear weapons in the area and the world, as far as I'm concerned. But to increase the number of countries and to have it, to have somebody like Iran, the regime in Iran, have a nuclear weapon is a very dangerous thing. And at this time...
Especially with Russia, Putin is saying. Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, let's move along from that happy thought and take a look at India, a country which you might think would have an enormous natural advantage in establishing harmonious and constructive relations with the Islamic world, specifically Earth's third largest Muslim population. In recent weeks, however, India's ambassadors across the Islamic world have spent weary hours absorbing recitations of the Riot Act from upwards of a dozen foreign ministries following a series of oafish remarks by officials of India's governing Bharatiya Janata Party, the party, of course, of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Somnath, it is, well, we should say, credit where due, etc., that both the BJP officials concerned have apologised profusely. One has been suspended by the party, the other one thrown out. The BJP have made a lot of pro forma declarations about no place for this sort of thing, respect all faiths, blah, blah, and indeed, blah. Is there any case here at all that with any political party, especially one as enormous as the BJP, you are going to have in the ranks a small number of unsavoury cranks who...
Small number.
who every so often, you've just about preempted my rhetorical question here, who every so often are going to say something daft or regrettable, or are we seeing here, is this policy, is this tactic on the part of the BJP?
I'll tell you an incident from today.
Go ahead.
The largest state in India, Uttar Pradesh, there were protests yesterday and day before against what has happened. The government authorized the demolition of houses of the leaders who were Muslim, who protested, took part in the protest.
Am I right in imagining that this has not calmed everything down?
Almost 80% of the news channels have been championing, saying this is Uttar Pradesh, this is what happens to rioters if you protest against the government. The rhetoric, indeed, as you say, the leaders have pulled back on the rhetoric, have suspended the two people involved who have said those words. But the government, I mean, UP is a BJP-led government, and it's happening this morning. The news media is championing it. Within India, there is this feeling, and very clearly, that internationally we were being sidelined, so we had to take some action. But the actions of the government otherwise, I mean, since 2014, what we have witnessed in India has been deplorable as far as you know, any kind of religious tolerance goes. We're not a secular democracy anymore in the last 8 years, what has happened in the country. The fact that leaders can go on national television, on public, saying the things they have said is, I mean, I cannot imagine. Can you imagine since 1947, since Nehru's India, being coming down to this in 80 years?
I mean, it is extraordinary. And the trajectory, Somnath, just to follow that up, is indeed depressing, because what I end up wondering is what the BJP imagines is the end point of this. Now, India is so hilariously vast that 200 million people does constitute a relative minority, but it's still 200 million people. What does the BJP imagine the end point of their relationship with the Muslim population of India actually is?
Oh, they would want a relationship where this 200 million is subservient to the majority rule, which is Hindu. They imagine a Hindu nation. They imagine laws, Hindu laws, and they imagine
no Sikhs, no Muslims, no.
Or, I mean, if they cannot completely, you know, vanish them off, they are not ones who will have any kind of power. They will be subservient to the majority. And this is the imagination. This has been the imagination from the inception of the RSS and the BJP. And it's depressing. As you say, it's the third biggest population. And I don't see a way out. You know, the conversation, the national discourse is so polarized, is so pro-Hindu, that the reaction to this is so muted. You know, there has been, because of this outrage, and justifiable outrage, there has been a mild pullback and, you know, just wrist slapping. Give it a week or so.
But Bari, on the subject of the outrage, much of which was led by the Gulf states, which we were talking about at the top of the show, I mean, as you understand it, what's their angle here? Because they could have chosen not to make a big thing of this. They could have just said, well, what are you going to do? A couple of people said something daft. It's not something we need to get particularly wound up about.
Yeah, this is much bigger than somebody said, because it's constant. It's a policy, as my colleague was saying. Also, don't forget, for example, I think maybe 60% of workers in countries like Dubai, Abu Dhabi are Indian. Mm-hmm. In the Gulf, billions of dollars is sent every single month in remittance. Every single month. And India needs this money. Hundreds of millions depend on this money. So they have to be very careful. I think if it was left up to the governments of the Gulf, maybe nobody would have said anything, to be honest with you. But they cannot but say something about it, because it was outrageous. I'm a person who have been to India a few times, and I loved it. I really enjoyed it. There's at least 200 languages, thousands of dances, poets, the cultural life, the colors, the it's so vibrant. And to have the PJB and Modi too, what they are doing to the fabric of the society and what India really constitutes. India was the leader of the non-allied countries. I remember I was the last journalist to interview Indira Gandhi before she died. And I remember asking her about that Sikh incident. And I think she really didn't want to go into it. I think she probably felt it was a big mistake. And by the way, after a few hours when I left her, she was killed by her Sikh guard. She actually did believe. She said, look, this is not who we are in India. I used to go trekking without any security with my father in Kashmir, in the mountains of Kashmir. Her father was Jawaharlal Nehru, of course. So, and I know Indian friends of mine that are secular, that are intellectuals, that are totally appalled. Imagine that in the schools, the PJB are teaching children lies after lies after lies. They're telling them, we created the internet. We are the first people to go to the moon. We are this, we are that.
Oh, Maria, stop it. This is so depressing.
I am so sorry, but I...
You're right.
It has to be exposed.
I know,
this
I know.
Is this the is, only way. Is, this yeah. is the only... And that's why I write. I write in the hope, and I'm sure you teach in the hope, of bringing truth and justice in the world. This yeah. is my only purpose, but, honestly.
But Somnath, is there... As a response to this overt and, as Bharia correctly points out, somewhat absurd propagation of this strange, austere Hindu nationalism, any kind of pushback from, I guess, the ideal version of Nehru's India, the great multicultural, multi-religious, secular republic? Is anybody, I guess, serious and influential in Indian politics attempting to make that case?
Well, as you said, India is a vast country of 1.2 billion people, so obviously there is resistance. But the... And, you know, there are newspapers, there are still some, if not progressive, at least centrist platforms where we discuss matters. But the oppression from the state has been so severe. The liberal universities have been taken over. VCs appoint, you know, political appointees in, for vice chancellors all over. Even the JNU, which was a bastion of progressive thought, theory. Politicians find their homes raided early morning from enforcement agencies. So the repercussions of any kind of stand against state ideology has been very severe. It has been remarkable. You know, not since emergency when democracy was curtailed, finished off, have we seen this kind of attack from... I mean, Congress was no progressive bastion. I'm not making a case for Congress.
But Congress is doing so badly in the elections and everywhere, and they don't have money to continue. Yeah. Unfortunately, the grandchildren of Indira Gandhi were not able to carry. You know how it is in these countries. The politics is it comes from the father to the son to the Holy Ghost.
Sorry, I must interject here and say Indira Gandhi has had a very dubious human rights track record from emergency to the Blue Star Movement.
I'm not defending her. I'm not defending her. I'm sorry. I'm just stating that India has never... This is equal to the far right in America. Yeah. This is equal to Orban. This is equal... Modi is one of those people, and we should not forget that at all. Indira Gandhi did not have a perfect human rights, but she was never in the same league. Never.
No, I agree. But this is also for different times. But, you know, I mean, you're so right. It's a very corrupt ideology. And it's not... I mean, sometimes also global forces take part. You know, what is happening in the US, right, as you just pointed out, or what is happening in Hungary,
Modi was the
Brazil.
Best friend of Trump. Did you see the rallies they had together?
Among them, certainly. Among them. Him, Kim Jong-un, with friends.
Illustrious like company.
Indeed, so.
But, you know, and just before we move off to a easier section, you seem to find these topics for me, and I get trolled like mad every evening after I finish a session here.
We do our best, Somnath. We do our best. But to move along to something entirely different and a bit of extremely unsubtle product placement, the new issue of Monocle magazine is on a newsstand near you shortly, and it contains our annual quality of life survey counting down the cities which Monocle considers most livable, agreeable and generally pleasant. To see if your hometown made the minor placings, you'll have to buy the issue, but for the purposes of prompting discussion right now, I can reveal that top spot is occupied, and for the second year running, by Copenhagen. There's always next year, Newport. Copenhagen, first of all, Bari, do we think of this is a plausible choice? It is, according to no less an authority than Monocle magazine, the best city in the world to live in.
Boring is your favorite place to be. Of course, it's Copenhagen. I'm sorry, Copenhagen. No ill feelings. But
you've just ruined your chances with Copenhagen and indeed probably with Monocle. But it's been
probably fun. No, but I think I can understand in a way why, because it's peaceful, because also it's clean, it's democratic in many ways.
It's all of that stuff.
Yes. Also, anxiety is not that great. So for me to live in a country that is really, and I'm hoping England will go back to its senses where I live, and we will have more democracy, more trust in our governors. There's anxiety in the world. People are anxious about so many things. And of course, the cost of living is probably one of the huge, the possibility of war in Europe, etc., etc. So for me, a place that I want to live will have classical music, ballet, and will have opera, and will have lovely flowers, and no Putins, no Erdogans.
Utopia.
No.
I mean, that does sound, you know, you can dream.
That
does, in fairness, sound quite a lot like Copenhagen, and I'm sure they've got opera and ballet and violins and bicycles.
Yes.
They've definitely got
it's very sanitized.
Yes. But their human rights record is a little bit now touch and go with the way they treat them.
This is not how you product place anything, Andrew.
Yeah, I know. This segment has unraveled completely. Somnath, what do you look for in a livable city?
I come from Calcutta, some amount of quiet.
I can see why being raised in Calcutta would lead you to want to crave quiet. I once spent about 2 weeks there and had to lie down in a dark room for about a month afterwards.
There you go. So
I kind of mean that as a compliment.
See, I'm from the global south and a vulgar Marxist. What would I want? I would want enough food on the table, healthcare, childcare, free education.
But I think they've got all that in Copenhagen as well.
Yes, there you go. Yeah. So any city, you know, which is fairly affluent as in Western Europe, I'm happy to be. But I do take various point, though. The sanitization is what gets to me a bit. Things should be a bit unruly, too, a bit messy. You can, you know.
Yeah. I'm just going to interject my own here. And it is for a city which does make the list, though I won't say where. And I was there quite recently. And I think, and I know Somnath, at least at this table, will agree with me, that a thing that a city that offers great quality of life should have is a fabulous sporting venue you can walk to from downtown along the river and walk back from, and in the specific case of the Melbourne Cricket Ground, to go and see a game of top flight football five rows back from the fence. This is Australian football, I mean, of course. Do you know what the ticket cost me? $27.10.
I just can't afford the flight.
That's about 15 quid.
I'm not coming with you, that's for sure.
And just to put a fine point here, Lord's cricket, the test, £120 per day.
I know.
5 day match. You know, that's almost my salary for a month.
Outrageous.
Oh, come on.
On that downbeat note, Somnath Battabail and Barry Alamuddin, thank you both, as always, for joining us on The Daily. And finally, on today's show, since Russia invaded Ukraine in February, more than 5 million Ukrainians are believed to have fled the country. They have travelled far and wide, including to Latin America, where they have been accompanied by a less reported influx of people fleeing Vladimir Putin's Russia. Lucinda Elliott, our correspondent in the region, sent us this report.
Ambling between meetings, along the streets of Buenos Aires, the distinct sound of the Russian language, brimming with consonants, is immediately identifiable above the open Spanish vowels. The Argentines boldly placing orders for another round of espressos and sticky media luna croissants. It struck me that while Argentina, Brazil, and to a lesser extent Bolivia, have a history of ties to Eastern Europe, hundreds of thousands crossed the Atlantic post-war in 1945, and after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's possibly a new wave of migration to South America taking place, one that's more subtle and less widely reported. Many people in Russia, or who hold nationality, now find themselves and their businesses entirely cut off from international markets, and they're on the hunt for a new place to call home. On a more practical level, getting hold of a visa to travel to the southern continent is fairly straightforward if you're Russian. Unlike the bureaucratic walls that have been built for entry to Europe and the US, as of 2019, no one from Russia needs an entry visa to visit all 12 South American nations. Suriname was the last to sign a bilateral visa-free travel arrangement 3 years ago. If you're coming from the United States, mind you, better get an application form ready. When it comes to recent sanctions, most governments on both the right and left in Latin America haven't introduced their own. Sputnik COVID vaccines were some of the first to arrive in the likes of Argentina and Paraguay, and broadly, long-standing diplomatic ties mean only a handful of leaders have openly condemned the invasion of Ukraine. So what's it like for Russians living in Buenos Aires? I sat down with Max, who arrived in the capital a few months ago with his wife and their two young children.
We came to Latin America 1 month ago before the war. We arrived in January to give birth to our son. And our son was born in Chile 1 day before Russian invasion on 22nd of February. Even before the February, we had been expecting problems in Russia for a long time. We saw very negative tendency concerning human rights in Russia. It's not hard to find Russian people in Buenos Aires. I think there are two main groups. Those who moved many years ago in Buenos Aires and those who moved here recently after February. Those who moved long ago are people from regional cities of Russia, not Moscow. And usually people who had very low income in Russia and problems with the job in Russia. So they moved to Argentina to find a job here.
Max explained how his local social media group on Telegram has roughly 1,000 members who discuss business opportunities in Latin America because of the enormous challenges faced at home.
I have a lot of friends in IT businesses, startups. Many of them have big problems, especially those who have plans going to other markets. It is extremely hard to raise capital now. It is extremely hard even to open business bank accounts. And it's very unfair because all entrepreneurs who want to start global businesses are against this move.
Business aside, these countries are also attractive because they're considered strong democracies with open societies, in stark contrast to today's Russia, and ones that have been built on decades of migration. Andre Manierko, originally from Moscow, lives in the southern Brazilian city of Florianopolis.
I have about 3 or 4 requests from friends to tell me how it is in Latin America. And most of them are surprised to know that I live in Florianopolis and I don't have to lock my bike. It's extremely safe and the quality of life is much higher than in Europe. In Brazil, it was very easy to connect to other Russian, Ukrainian and Belarusians because there are plenty of Facebook groups, Telegram and WhatsApp chats where Russians connect to each other. The history of immigration to Brazil is long. And it was easy to get in touch with them, and I've got a lot of help from the Russian community. I wouldn't say that living in Brazil is difficult. I'm thinking of staying here for good in Russia right now. Most business owners understand that the economy is falling apart, and a lot of people are closing businesses in advance before it has collapsed. Also, import and export is practically impossible and prohibited. So a lot of people are forced to stop their businesses.
Back in Buenos Aires, Fernando Strafache is second in command at City Hall and specializes in international relations. At their headquarters, he said that he hadn't seen a notable uptick in arrivals from Russia, but explained why the Argentine capital is an attractive destination for the community.
Y además los índices de objetivos de criminalidad bajaron todos.
After Ottawa in Canada, we are the city with the fewest homicides in all of the Americas. We are considered safe. This, combined with the return of what we offer culturally, theaters have reopened, etc., has made us a top destination, first for our neighbors in the region and others who are choosing to come. The city has absolutely nothing against people from Russia. In fact, our main theater, The Colon, is considered bringing a Russian performance that was cancelled in New York to the city. We want to send a completely different signal because we believe in it. What has the Russian population got to do with the mad actions of their leader? and Buenos Aires has an opportunity to position itself as a peaceful, interesting, and accessible capital. Our position is that we are a great city to live, study, work, and do business. The heart of Buenos Aires is its people. It's not the natural surroundings of the city or monuments, it's the people. And that is built on diversity. That those from different religious, sexual orientations, and racial backgrounds come together here peacefully is what cements our identity as a capital city.
Paisaje natural, es la gente. Lo que hace a Buenos Aires interesting es la gente.
Both Max and Andre agree and seem to have found a compassion that surprised them so many miles away from home.
People in Argentina are super friendly, super, super friendly to me and to other Russians who I know. They're very open. They are very warm to us. I have lots of conversations, like in taxi or in shop, in restaurant, when people ask me where I'm from and they say that I'm from Russia, and people ask me what's going on in Russia. And when I'm saying that I moved to Buenos Aires, like everybody says, welcome to Buenos Aires, you will be happy here.
Most people I've met in Brazil who find out that I'm Russian are extremely compassionate. I have not met any hostility, and a lot of people feel sorry for the president that we have and for the situation that that we as Russians who think differently to the government are in.
Thanks to Lucinda Elliott for that report. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Baria Alamuddin and Somnath Batabail. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie and researched by Lillian Fawcett and Isabel Rosen. Our sound engineer was Callum McLean. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.